Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Since this is the first episode of the show's 2024 season, the welcome back part of the intro is particularly relevant. Look, you're going to hear this to the point of utter cliche, but 2024 really is going to be one of the most consequential years of our lifetimes. And I hope you all continue to tune into the show as we work to figure out how to navigate this moment together. I thought I'd kick things off on a topic that could be make or break over the next 12 months, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. My guest today is Yaroslav Trofimov, the Wall Street Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent and author of Our Enemies Will Vanish, The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War of Independence. Out today and available in our bookshop, linked in the show notes as per usual. Our Enemies Will Vanish is the best book I've read on the history of the war, especially when combined with Yaroslav's on-the-ground reporting as a native Ukrainian. I also spend a significant amount of time in the episode asking about the pressing issues that will define the war this year. Why the counteroffensive succeeded in 2022 but failed in 2023, whether or not there was a chance to negotiate a settlement early in the war, Zelensky's performance both in Ukraine and allied capitals, and whether 2024 will be marked by victory, defeat, or stalemate for either side. And last but not least, I want to just say a huge thank you to everyone who supports the show via our Supercast subscription. It's how we not only put out such a high volume of quality content, but honestly, it helps us just keep the lights on in the first place. So I just want to say that starting this weekend, we're going to be increasing the amount of exclusive and interesting content for folks. I think you will get a kick out of what's going to be on offer. And if you'd like to not only get access to exclusive content like the Q&A episodes that we previously featured, you can go to realignment.supercast.com. And of course, a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Hope you enjoy this conversation. Yaroslav Trofimov, welcome to The Realignment.
Great to be on the show.
We are recording this in late December going into 2024. Obviously, this is coming out on the release date of your new book, but just as things stand in late December, what would just be your broad assessment of the state of the war?
Well, you know, Ukraine is still standing. Ukraine has won the most important thing, which is its independence, which is something that Russia and Putin tried to crush when they launched the invasion almost 2 years ago. It hasn't recovered its territorial integrity yet, at least. It hasn't reclaimed some 20% of Ukrainian land that still remains under Russian occupation. But the war now, for now, at least, is about the borders in which an independent Ukraine will survive, persist, grow, develop, not about whether Ukraine and the Ukrainian nation and the Ukrainian people will survive as a state and as a culture.
I think what I'd love to understand then is why there seems to be, in Washington especially, this feeling of defeat, this feeling of an accomplishment, because especially by the standards of what we in the West expected to occur before the invasion of February, the current outcome is incredible. And it seems as if this is only categorized as defeat if we define victory in almost unrealistic terms relative to, I think, the truly consequential accomplishment, which is, to your point, independence, validity of nationhood, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think about this dynamic?
Well, let's just think about what happened when the war began and what the expectation was. You know, the Ukrainian foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, was in Washington on the eve of the invasion, and he told me that when he went to see President Biden in the White House, it was like being diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. There were all these handshakes and smiles, but they're really farewells for him and for Ukraine as a state. And the American embassy in Kyiv had shut down. American personnel were withdrawn. There wasn't much of a weapons flow to Ukraine. Everybody had sort of given up on Ukraine. Every Western country assumed that Kyiv will fall within 3 days, or maybe in a week, and so did the Russians. And Kyiv did not fall in 3 days, and Ukraine fought back against the Russians in the beginning, using mostly its own, you know, Soviet standard weapons, and managed to liberate the north of Ukraine, push the Russians away from Kyiv, destroyed the most elite Russian formations. That was already a miracle. And then there was another miracle later in the year when Ukraine broke through Russian lines inflicted a catastrophic defeat on the Russians in the Kharkiv region, you know, capturing hundreds of tanks, armored vehicles, artillery pieces, and then liberated Kherson. And so people, I think, had slightly exaggerated expectations about what would happen the following year with the Ukrainian counteroffensive. But also, there is the issue of a historical opportunity that had been lost, because when Ukraine was pushing through with such great successes in the summer of 2022, it was asking for tanks, Western-made tanks. It was asking for fighter jets. It was asking for artillery pieces that were not forthcoming at the time. And the big preoccupation in Washington was what would Russia do and whether Russia would use nuclear weapons to strike Ukraine. And so there was a lot of back and forth between the administration and Putin's government. And one of the assessments in Washington was that a catastrophic defeat of the Russian army would be one of the triggers for Putin to start using nukes. And so Ukraine wasn't allowed, really, to inflict a catastrophic defeat on the Russian military at a time when it possibly could. Because let's remember, President Putin did not mobilize reservists at the time, because that would have been an admission that his so-called special military operation was not going to plan. And so in September, October 2022, there were about 100,000 Russian troops in Ukraine who hadn't dug in, who had poor command, and were really on the brink of a complete catastrophe. But since then, you know, Putin mobilized hundreds of thousands. He says now there are about 600,000 plus troops in Ukraine. And the Russians spent a year digging fortifications. So when the Ukrainians finally got all those weapons that they didn't get a year earlier, despite asking for them, it was difficult. And the Ukrainian counteroffensive was not very successful. There was very minimal gain of land. But let's think about what happened after that. The Ukrainian counteroffensive began about June 2023, kind of ran out of steam by, let's say, September, October. And then since then, the Russians have been trying their own counteroffensive to retake cities like Avdiivka and Kupiansk, and they have very little to show for. You know, they have amassed massive losses and inched forward, you know, in a very, very limited fashion.
One of the topics I'm always interested in from a historical perspective is whether in a specific era of conflict, offense versus defense is favored or not. The classic example, obviously, is going to be World War One. Would just the takeaway of the past 2 years just be that defense has just an inherent tilt towards it in the current moment relative to potential stalemate, relative to how difficult it is to make significant advancements in kilometers at very high cost? Like, how do you think of the offensive versus defensive advantage here?
Yes, I think let's think also about the technology, because technology has changed the way wars are fought in the last 2 years. And it's a very important takeaway, not just for the Russians and the Ukrainians, but also for the US military and every other military. I think the appearance of drones at every level of combat, down to, you know, individual squads running their own drone operations, is something new. So it's really, really hard for any military formation now to have a large movement, sort of what the US doctrine calls combined arms warfare. You know, you just cannot have more than two or three tanks moving anywhere without being spotted within a few minutes and then attacked by these flying munitions and everything else that your enemy has got. And so when the Ukrainians tried to do it in the summer, they failed. And when the Russians tried to do it in October, November, December, they have also failed, just because you know, they cannot move undetected. And so drones are now everything. You know, drones are artillery, drones are ISR, drones are basically, you know, nothing is done without the drones in the modern battlefield now. And that has changed, I think, profoundly the nature of warfare.
So when you were making your point about the lack of F-16s, the slow delivery of the tanks, which is really what you're talking about in late 2022, I kind of wonder which at the end of the day ended up being more decisive from a Ukrainian long-term success perspective, the lack of F-16s or just the lack of ammunition, the lack of artillery shells, because it seems like we could focus on platforms versus just like the deeply unsexy reality that the West broadly has a production problem. And despite the various financial sanctions on the Russian economy, the obviously the fact that Putin needs to get some sort of win from this has incentivized them just to go for wartime production at a level that means they're not suffering from similar artillery shell gaps. I'm curious how you'd think about that dynamic.
I think both points are valid. I think obviously the war in Ukraine is primarily in an artillery war, and the Russian way of war was dependent in the beginning on having this massive advantage both in the artillery pieces and in munitions. You know, they would fire 10 shells for every Ukrainian shell fired in response. So the US and European countries had announced they would ramp up production. That obviously haven't kept up with the promises. It's been, you know, much more difficult than thought initially. You know, the European Union had promised 1 million shells in 2023, delivered only about 300,000. So, but if you look at this summer of 2023, Ukraine actually did not have an artillery ammunition shortfall, in part because South Korea had shipped hundreds of thousands of shells. And so for several months during the counteroffensive, Ukraine actually, for the first time in the war, had an artillery ammunition advantage over the Russians. That didn't help much because of all the other things at play. For example, you know, Russia was able to use its combat helicopters very efficiently, firing missiles that were just slightly longer range than Ukrainian field air defenses and destroying dozens of tanks, or maybe hundreds of tanks and armored vehicles. So F-16s would have been very useful at that time. But also, if you look at the sort of the curve of the war itself, every time a new capability would come, it would be just a little bit too late. Sometimes a little bit too late, like the HIMARS. They still, you know, were instrumental in destroying Russian supply lines in the summer of 2022 and then allowing the Ukrainians to take Kherson. But the tanks and the armored vehicles, the Bradleys, they only came mid-2023. And so by then, you know, they didn't really allow Ukraine, the Russian defenses didn't really allow Ukraine to have this sort of mechanized armored punch that would have been so devastating to the Russians a year earlier.
Something, and I want to be incredibly fair to the Ukrainians here, because I'm, you know, sitting in Austin, Texas, so it's easy for me to kind of Monday morning quarterback here. But when I hear critics of Washington's policy not defend the counteroffensive running out of steam, but basically just say, look, we didn't give them the missiles we needed. We didn't give them the weapons they requested. This counteroffensive didn't receive the resources it needed to actually achieve its goals. If that was true, let's just posit that for a second, then why launch a counteroffensive? That seems to be just the immediate counter that I come up with, which is like, okay, if Washington and the EU and the broader allies are not furnishing Ukraine with the technology and the weapons it needs to win, then why launch a counteroffensive who, separate from the actual strategic reality on the battlefield, is clearly being the perceived failure is driving the lack of additional aid and broader discord in the West. I'm just curious how you think about that dynamic.
Yeah, I think there were mistakes made all around. I think there were mistakes made on a sort of very tactical level. I think there was a mistake in the selection of the units that got the Western armor and new Western weapons because for the offensive. Because what happened is that instead of taking existing brigades that had spent a year fighting, that had a pretty good unit cohesion, that had staffs that had worked together with each other and knew how to fight war in real-time conditions, there was this fetish of Western NATO training. So Ukraine had trained brand new brigades in Germany and other European countries with the US and other NATO instructors who taught them part of the US combined arms doctrine. But it's sort of useless in Ukraine because you can't have combined arms warfare without an air force on one hand. And on the other hand, that what they taught them did not include very real things that Ukraine does do on its own, like, you know, the integration of Starlink communications and battle man, so that allow sort of these battle space management platforms to work across the field, and drone technology, because the Ukrainians are much more advanced in the actual battlefield use of drone technology against a, you know, a modern military force than the U.S. is, because the U.S. has never done that, right? And so these new brigades, when they launched the offensive, it turned out that they weren't properly trained yet, and they, you know, some of their staffs didn't know what to do, and you know, there were communication breakdowns, and at the end of the day, battalions from the existing older brigades had to be sent to sort of infuse the new forces. So there were at least tactical errors. And they stemmed, I think, in part from underestimating the strength of the Russian military, you know, sort of the assumptions that the Russians, because they were so incompetent in 2022, would still be incompetent in 2023, and they weren't, clearly, because they were very competent in preparing defenses, and General Surovikin was a very smart military leader, and it's Ukraine's fortune that he had been fired by Putin because of his alleged links with the Wagner Group after the Prigozhin putsch. Ukrainian commanders will tell you that the Russians did all the right things, and it worked greatly for them. And then on the other hand, you do have this underestimation of Ukrainian native knowledge, and like I said, sort of the fetishization of NATO training, NATO doctrine. But, you know, the U.S. military has not fought against a near-peer adversary since the Korean War, probably. So a lot of the skills that the Western militaries have from Afghanistan and Iraq are not really applicable to the reality in Ukraine.
Yeah, and I think I like your articulation of, like, the fetishization of NATO-American combined arms tactics, especially when actual weapons platforms like the HIMARS were game changers. So it seems as if we extended the clear, I think, technological superiority, or at least like incredible effectiveness for those weapons in the battlefield, we extended that logic onto the actual tactics and change and tactics and ability to perform in the field. So something that I would love to hear your answer on, especially given how you wrote the book, which I once again, really illustrate for folks, people really need to read this book to understand Thank what's you. Happening here. You're writing this book as a reporter, obviously, but you're also writing this book as a Ukrainian. So I would like for you to kind of answer this question on like two different levels. So level one would just be your analytical side, and then level two would be your personal side. What is the Ukrainian mood right now, especially when it comes to definition of victory? How long could this be held out? I'm sure you've seen this reporting, but the thing that anti-Ukraine aid supporters in the U.S. have been bandying about on Twitter for the past week or so has really been they're recruiting men in their 40s and 50s. The manpower is exhausted. The stalemate is continuing and not going anywhere. Obviously, that reporting and those facts are clearly shifting the debate in the United States. How is that reporting and those facts on the ground impacting the Ukrainian side of the equation?
Yeah. So it's let's sort of dismantle this layer by layer. I think first of all about the war goals, right? It's not like Putin is saying, let's stop the war and freeze it as it is. He just said last week and repeatedly over the last, you know, several months that, you know, Odessa and Kharkiv are Russian cities. You know, the Russian deputy head of the National Security Council, former President Medvedev, put up a picture of a Russian flag in Kiev on Russia's Independence Day. So Russia still wants all of Ukraine, and it's encouraged by the, you know, political dysfunction, or let's say political debate, that has stalled American support for Ukraine, that goal is achievable once again. The Ukrainians don't really have an option. You know, what are they going to do? Surrender? You know, allow Russian troops to march into Kiev? So Ukraine will fight. And yes, it's true that Ukraine has had heavy losses, as did Russia. It's a bloody war. But these losses are still, you know, by the standards of the wars of the past, are quite limited. Ukraine still has many million fighting age men who can fight. If you go to Kiev and walk the street, you know, the streets are full of young men. And if anything, it's been by design that Ukraine has been focusing more on older men rather than younger men, because pretty much everybody in their 40s and 50s had served in the Soviet army. And so they actually have skills, like they know how to drive a tank or how to fire a howitzer. You know, younger men don't necessarily. And also psychologically, I've heard a lot of sort of men in the 40s and 50s in Ukraine saying, you know, I would rather go fight myself. It's okay if I die, but at least my son will not have to fight. because he still has to raise children, you know, get married and all that. So I think there is a lot of also sort of social reasons why older men fight. But, you know, if you look at the Russians, it's kind of the same. If you look at the, you know, I've met a lot of Russian POWs, and they're not young men in the prime of health either. So a lot of his problems are mirrored instead of the Russian army as well.
I'm on the aid to Ukraine side, but you know, from a fairness perspective, I'm trying to say this empirically. It seems to me that what the Ukraine just needs to negotiate an end to this war side doesn't seem to comprehend is what you said a few seconds ago about Russia still having broader designs on all of Ukraine. It would be one thing if Putin's position was, look, we've held on to the Donbass. We're keeping Crimea. You're never getting it back. That's the ceasefire. That's the peace deal. But that very much seems to not be on the table in any way whatsoever. And throughout the book, you catalog the various actual demands the Russians have brought to the table when it's come to peace deals. And setting aside the validity of the actual claim. So, for example, I the articulation of 50,000, the first one was 50,000 man army, only pistols and rifles. So obviously throw away all of the Western capabilities, neutrality, quote unquote. I personally think those claims are unreasonable from the start. But those claims are also being made after 15 or 20 years of broken promises, failed negotiations, and bad faith. So I just love for you to kind of like unpack that side of things, because I genuinely think this is the biggest gap of American understanding. They think there's a degree of reasonableness when it comes to potential negotiated outcomes.
Well, there isn't any. I mean, let's remember where we stand now from the point of view of Russian law, Russian constitution. You know, Russia annexed four Ukrainian regions, none of which it controls in full, in October 2022. Zaporizhia, Kherson, Donetsk, and Luhansk. Two of the capitals of these regions are in Ukrainian hands. One of them, Zaporizhia, was never in Russian hands. So the entire fighting has been occurring over the last year and a half, pretty much, since October 2022, is occurring as per Russia on the territory of Russia to liberate Russia. You know, Putin agreeing to freeze the front lines on the current levels would actually be a breach of Russian criminal law and of the Russian constitution. And so, of course, they want more. I mean, the current front lines, if they're frozen, would be an admission of defeat for Putin. Would be an admission of being unable to achieve the strategic goals of the war, which is to subvert Ukraine as an independent country and to block Ukraine from developing in an independent fashion that is not controlled by Russia. And so, of course, they still want Kiev. And of course, they're not reasonable. And of course, they're not interested in any freezing of the conflict, the current lines, unless, you know, it comes with the sanctions relief and allows them to try again in a year or two or three. But even then, you know, it's politically safer for Putin to keep fighting the war than to stop the war.
And I think this is also where the cessation of U.S. aid becomes an impediment to any negotiated outcome. From a pure political perspective, if Putin knows that U.S. aid is coming to a close, European aid isn't happening quick enough, why in any way would he negotiate? The incentive on his part is just to outlast and continue, because he obviously, as a non-democratic ruler, has a different timeline than any of his Western counterparts. So how is that side of things operationalizing itself? It just seems like the incentive for Putin is to maybe turn up the dial, turn down the dial, retreat, move forward, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he seems to have, at least for now, barring a breakthrough on the Ukrainian side, the ability just to survive in a not great status quo, but a survivable politically status quo for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the losses that Russia is incurring in Ukraine are not politically an issue in Russia. You know, look, you know, thousands of Russian men agreed to go to the front line and die in Ukraine. and it hasn't caused protests. It hasn't endangered his rule. The acquiescence is actually quite stunning if you look at it, because you know you can understand why Ukrainians are willing to go and die. They're defending their own country. But for someone from Siberia, think that it's preferable to agree to go and fight rather than stay at home, maybe risk, you know, a prison term. It's, you know, it's quite mind-boggling, because also the casualty rates of the Russian troops on the front lines are very, very high. So politically, the less support there is for Ukraine, the less incentive it is for Putin to stop the war. I mean, that's clear. I mean, he still banks on one day outlasting the West and achieving victory and seizing Kyiv. I think that was his plan from day one. You know, he convinced himself that Western democracies are fickle, will do nothing. And if you look at how the war started, that was kind of like he was kind of right. You know, the Western democracies just washed their hands of Ukraine and said, okay, well, nothing we can do. We'll close our embassies and leave. And surprisingly, Ukraine didn't collapse. And then there was a reassessment in the West.
Yeah, and I'd love for you actually to unpack the time, because I think you actually tell this very effectively in the book and the way you present the narrative, like the timeline here. There is a lot of, I know people don't like this term always, but genuine misinformation and disinformation around Western intentions towards Ukraine. So there'll be this narrative of, oh, we were so close to getting a negotiated peace back in March of 2022, Boris Johnson jets in, Boris Johnson shuts it down because Boris Johnson thinks this is a chance to throw away Ukrainian lives to defeat Russia, because Boris Johnson, like most of the West, is stuck in this Cold War mentality. However, when you just read the basic timeline of what actually happened here, Bucha on like the other end of it, but also just the fact that Ukraine is clearly on the offensive, and the fact that at the start of the war, the West didn't believe Ukraine could survive at all. It just doesn't seem like the kind of pro-Russian narrative here makes that much sense. So that's just my reading of like the dynamic here. I'd love for you to just kind of unpack Western intentions and how that manifested in the negotiations in 2022.
Right. So, I mean, the negotiations actually started 4 days after the war began, you know, the Ukrainians going via Poland to Belarus. And at the time, the Russian demands were pretty much capitulation, you know, puppet government. You even have to rename the streets of your cities, you know, disband your military. So, you know, the Russians basically wanted the end of Ukraine. And then the resistance inflicted more and more pain on the Russians. In the following weeks, the Russians sent some of the best units, their airborne troops, across the Irpin River to a town called Moschun, north of Kyiv. And that was probably the defining battle of the defense of Kyiv, which was won in part by the sheer courage of all sorts of Ukrainian volunteers and units, and even some of the foreign volunteers by then who flocked there, but also by a very clever use of nature. You know, the Ukrainians decided to blow up the dam that connects that river to the bigger river, Dnipro. And suddenly, this Russian foothold in Moschun was isolated not by a narrow little stream, but by, you know, several, you know, by a very wide body of water that they could no longer cross on pontoons. And so that strategic defeat was inflicted on the Russians a few days before the big meeting in Istanbul began. And so by then, the Russians knew they have to withdraw from the area of Kyiv, because they just couldn't sustain the troops. They lost so many of the best units, and the Ukrainians were encroaching on their supply lines, just picking off convoys and tanks and just making life unbearable for the Russians. And so in Istanbul, the Russian demands were much more moderate. They no longer demanded the disbanding of the Ukrainian army. They wanted a smaller army, but still, you know, army that now, you know, had heavy weapons. And the main demand was Ukraine abandoning its aspiration to join NATO. And so the Ukrainian delegation in Istanbul was not empowered to sign anything. It was there to talk and see what the Russian position is. And they were stunned, just like everyone else, when the Russian delegates announced in Istanbul on March 29th that the Russian troops are withdrawing from the Kyiv area, because most of the goals of the special military operation had been achieved. And so on the next day, the Russians were already gone from Bucha, which is the suburb of Kiev. And when the Ukrainian army entered, they just saw the scenes of massacre. Now, you know, 450 people, maybe more, had been murdered by the Russians in Bucha in the space of a couple of weeks. There were bodies lying everywhere, you know, some of them, but pretty horrendous injuries. You know, the Ukrainians found young men shot in the back of their heads in one of the courtyards. And so the wave of outrage was immense. And it's also, you know, the first time that the Ukrainians were confronted with evidence of what the Russians do to Ukrainians. You know, there are other places where atrocities were happening, you know, most notably the city of Mariupol, where tens of thousands of Ukrainians were murdered. But, you know, the Russians are still in Mariupol. They hid the evidence. They bulldozed the mass graves. In Bucha, they didn't have time to do that. So when Zelensky came to Bucha days later, it was, you know, it was his first trip outside of Kiev since the war began. It was a shock to him. It was a shock to the nation. You know, everybody was examining this evidence, and the Russians were unrepentant. The Russians were denying that they had done anything. You know, the chief Russian negotiator in Istanbul, Medinsky, even said that the Ukrainians made up the massacre in Bucha because it rhymes with the English word butcher, and so this was all for the Anglo-Saxons' benefit. The Ukrainians recoiled because they understood that the Russian goal is to annihilate Ukraine as a people, not just NATO membership. And that's when Boris Johnson came. And Boris Johnson told me that, you know, he came with a message that, you know, don't trust the Russians. If the Russians sign anything with you, that's just to prepare for the next step, as has already happened with the previous two agreements that Russia signed with Ukraine in 2014, 2015, the so-called Minsk agreements. And, you know, and Boris Johnson did tell Zelensky, you know, we will back you 1,000%. You know, it's Ukraine's choice, but we'll be there for you. Not sure to what extent the U.S. Was in the loop on that. And I'm told by the Biden administration that Johnson was not coordinating with them necessarily. But Zelensky didn't need much persuasion because I think his mind was already set, as was the mind of most other Ukrainians, that after Bucha, you can't really trust Russia, because they have shown their true face there. And also, you know, Russia had suffered a massive military defeat around Kiev. So the situation has changed in the battlefield.
And once again, there are a variety of opinions in what Western policy towards Ukraine should be, but I think it's just important that we operate from the same set of facts. The point of this timeline, me hearing you recounting this story, is that it seems as if the negotiations in Istanbul were doomed by, once again, defeat in Kyiv, Bucha, and just like the shifting dynamics, whether or not Boris Johnson gave some sort of speech. Because once again, there are plenty of leaders in the West, including those in the Biden administration, who are not happy with various decisions the Ukrainians have made. I just think it's ridiculous to claim that, you know, one Western leader has the ability to, so I think, dictate terms in that specific way. But something that, once again, this came out in your writing that I want to make clear for folks. Obviously, Mariupol and the destruction of the theater, you know, thousands of, you know, men, women and children just murdered horrifically, various different situations. Like at a minimum, though, that not excused once again, but that's war to take cities, urban warfare. We see this in Gaza. I think on one degree, that's understandable from a final settlement perspective. On the other, the point of Bucha was just, the Russians occupied for a month. And this is what happens in Russian occupied territories where the actual army to army fighting had ceased. So if that is what's happening to Ukrainian held territory after Ukraine has essentially left that specific battlefield, it's hard to imagine a world where Ukraine could in good faith give away huge portions of the country in exchange for supposed peace deals, when that has just happened at that moment. So I think people really just have to understand like the significance of what that meant in contrast to what was happening in the rest of the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, like in Mariupol, it wasn't just during the combat. It was just the bombing. You know, in the days afterwards, the Russians were just going around murdering people. You know, there was one foreign journalist left, a Lithuanian filmmaker, who was just stopped at the checkpoint and then shot in the head, and his wife found his body days later in a garbage heap. So it's just, we know about Bucha because the Russians left and the evidence was there to be uncovered. And but I think also the nature of the war was what kind of the Ukrainian understanding about Russia's goals and the nature of the war had changed. After Bucha, they realized that it's really a genocidal program of wiping out Ukrainians as a people, destroying the language, banning language, which is what the Russians talk about now quite openly, and basically turning, destroying the elites and turning Ukrainians into Russians and murdering everyone who is opposed to that. That was the Russian goal. And I think it took Bucha for many Ukrainians to realize it.
I think it's hard as a Westerner to, on a couple levels, put myself in the position of the Russians to understand the, you know, base motivations here. But it just seems, from a practical perspective, every single act they've taken has been in opposition to what I think their actual objectives are. So once again, if your objective is making clear that Ukraine and Russia are one people, and these are all just kind of social artificial constructions, engaging in acts of genocide, engaging in acts of murder, are the exact opposite you'd want it to do. So I don't want to just turn the Russians into kind of orcs or turn them kind of into cartoon villains, but it actually seems at a practical level, putting aside the morality of the broader objectives, they have essentially behaved as cartoon villains with the decisions that they've made. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's really strange. Well, I mean, I think it all flows from the basic misconception about Ukraine. As you said, you know, Putin thought that Ukrainians are Russians, they're one people, and, you know, his troops will be welcomed with flowers, at least in the Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine, of, you know, cities like Kharkiv or Odessa or Kherson or Mykolaiv, and they weren't. And there was no plan B. So there was a lot of lashing out and a lot of just murderous behavior, which, you know, there's a long tradition in the Russian military of rapes, murders, looting, you know.
Within Russia proper, you know, like within Russia itself too. So,
well, within Russia, in Chechnya, if you want to look at the behavior of Soviet soldiers at the end of World War II in occupied parts of Europe, you know, in Poland, in Yugoslavia, there were complaints about mass rapes as well. So it's not something that is not happened in the history of the Russian military. But going back to Ukraine, I think the paradox was that Putin had thought that the Russian-speaking people of Ukraine would be his natural allies. But it's the Russian-speaking areas, such as Kharkiv, such as Mariupol, that really bore the brunt of destruction. That's where so many of the civilians were killed, you know, entire neighborhoods wiped out. And I remember I was talking to the mayor of Kharkiv after a particularly bad day, sort of walking in an area where people had just been killed by Russian shelling, you know, carbonized corpses in the streets, being pulled out from smoldering cars. So I went to see the mayor, who is a Russian speaker, who has never publicly spoken in Ukrainian, out of principle. And he said that, you know, now the true Ukrainian, the real Ukrainian patriots, the people who really oppose the Russia with every fiber of their soul, are the Russian speakers, because it's in cities like Kharkiv that have been receiving, you know, death and destruction from Russia every day, whereas in many of the Ukrainian-speaking parts of the country out west, war is something on television, not something that destroys your apartment and kills your friends and relatives. And then, you know, it's a historical shift. I think that the hatred for Russia and the Russian state and all these areas that Putin claims are Russian lands will be there for generations.
I think that's the easiest way of articulating this, because there really was, because once again, to my point, sometimes the Russian propaganda and articulations of war aims seem cartoonish, but there was actual belief there. There is actual belief that Ukraine is a Western propped up artificial state. And once you actually run into the manifestly clear counterexample of that, mass death, destruction, no flowers in the street, that is going to provoke a reaction that isn't going to be purely rational, as if we're playing a game of Risk and just moving pieces around on the table. So, you know, in this last section, here's what I'd love to understand. Obviously, it's hard to make predictions going into 2024, so I don't want to ask that specifically, but I want to ask about prospects. It seems as if 2022 is really a year where there was a lot of hope for the Ukrainian cause in the West, especially. 2023 seems to be ending on a down note. There's talk of defeat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. From my perspective, I would define Ukrainian defeat as losing Odessa, Russia is backing Kyiv, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What, from your perspective, are the prospects for a catastrophic outcome like that if additional USA doesn't come, if the Europeans are still slow in those contexts?
I think the Ukrainian defeat of such catastrophic proportions can only happen because of internal reasons. It can only happen if the Ukrainian society that has held together politically all these years of war starts imploding. And we haven't seen serious cracks. We have seen some tensions, but we haven't really seen serious cracks. So I think as long as Ukrainians remain united, they are strong enough to prevent such a catastrophe. And obviously, you know, without American aid, they will pay a very high price in lives. You know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands will have to die because of the lack of American funding. But it's not like I have a choice of surrendering, because they know that there will be a higher price over the generations if Ukraine is absorbed into Russia and if Ukraine is wiped out. You know, the history speaks for itself. But things are not as catastrophic as, you know, like, you know, through this whole war, there was a bit of an emotional yo-yo, sort of big highs and big lows that don't necessarily reflect the situation on the ground. I mean, the Russians have not been able to advance much in the past 3 months, even as Ukraine is very low on ammunition. And yes, you know, the Russians may take a town or two, you know, they may take Avdiivka, but they haven't really captured anything of significance except this town of Bakhmut since the summer of 2022, despite throwing enormous resources in it. And the city of Bakhmut was only captured at a cost of 30,000 Wagner recruits and destroying Wagner, the most combat efficient Russian formation, as a fighting force. So, you know, Ukraine is not as weak as people think. It's not necessarily as strong as people hoped for. And the same can be said about Russia. So I think instead of a catastrophic collapse, what's most likely to happen in the coming month is more and more of this grinding combat, in which, you know, any delay in Western weapons will be measured in Ukrainian lives.
What are the prospects for Europeans to fill the gaps that the lack of American aid has given? Just because I just know from my own contacts in Washington within Republican Hill circles, a lot of folks are fairly confident there will be no additional American aid for the foreseeable future, given the specific politics in DC around this question. So at what point will there just be a pivot to accepting that the US has politically given what it can give, and that the Europeans have to fill more of the role than they've filled previously? Not that the Europeans aren't giving serious aid, but there's just a, to your point, around a million shells and only 300,000 shells. Like, that's the type of gap that needs to be closed.
Right. I mean, I think there's a gap in production on both sides of the Atlantic. And the European countries, I mean, they're not, you know, they're not all on the same page. But obviously, countries like Poland or the Baltic states or Finland and Sweden and Norway and Denmark and the Netherlands have been very, very active in giving to Ukraine much more in terms of percentage of the economies than the U.S. But I think Germany, especially Germany, does understand that a catastrophic, or even not a catastrophic, significant Ukrainian defeat is a problem for the national security of Germany, much more so than we would for America, because there is no ocean between Germany and Russia. And so you do see the German government, you know, increasing its funding finding ways to, safeguard it from any other funding issues. But the question is capacity. I mean, how fast can they ramp up their production? How fast can they make all this ammunition and equipment that Ukraine does need? And, you know, Europe also has its political problems. We have Hungary that has just blocked $50 billion in aid to Ukraine. Now, European officials say it's temporary, and in February that could be resolved. But the fact is that, Hungary has been playing the role of a spoiler in Europe as well.
For these last few, I'm curious, and this is once again speaking to the book specifically, I'd like for you to talk about the role of the press when it comes to covering this war and explaining the war to the outside world, because I always bring this up on Ukraine podcasts, but I personally remember back in June 2023, David Ignatius at the Washington Post wrote a piece where he, it was at the start of the counteroffensive, and he said, like, this is Ukraine's D-Day. And as a person who just works in American politics, I thought that was a disastrous framing of Ukraine's prospects, frankly, because the second that you define this as D-Day, an American audience that's been raised on Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan and just sort of World War II narratives are going to expect D-Day level results. Obviously, you have a very tough month and a half in Normandy getting out of the hedgerows, but broadly speaking, by August, like, you're on the road to Berlin. Obviously, that timeline didn't occur. So I think that was a very direct example of how influential people in the press, I know he's an opinion columnist, but all this kind of mixes together, I think allowed valiant, morally just narratives to get in the way of their analytical analysis in a way that I actually think harmed Ukraine's prospects long term, because now critics of Ukraine policy can justifiably say, look, you promised us D-Day, you promised us big accomplishments. Instead, this is a grinding stalemate. I'm not comfortable supporting that. So I think that's a kind of an example of how the press narratives could shape this perspective. You don't have to comment on David, but I'm just curious how you personally think about writing a book in the first person and telling these stories.
Yeah, I mean, so let me just go back to the sort of the issue of the grinding stalemate. Obviously, grinding stalemate is much better than a Russian victory. So it's not like we're having a choice between, Ukrainian victory or stalemate. You know, the choice is between, Ukrainian defeat is a stalemate as well if the funding doesn't come through. So, me personally, I think for me, it was very important to explain Ukraine because there's so many misconceptions flying around it. You know, nobody knew much about Ukraine before the war. And whatever people knew was often through the lens of Russian understanding of Ukraine, which was a sort of a colonial understanding, misunderstanding of Ukraine. Just trying to portray what people in Ukraine think, how they behave, and, what drives them, I think was very important for me. And, I've covered a lot of wars in my life. Unfortunately, I had now to cover a war in the place where I was born. And that was very different. And in some ways, it was more difficult, obviously, psychologically. But on the other level, unlike in Iraq, unlike in Afghanistan, I really could understand the finest nuances. What was driving people, of the conversations, of the mindset, and sort of have this almost visceral understanding of what is driving them.
So for these last two, number one, you wrote a really great piece in the Wall Street Journal about Gaza and Ukraine. This has just obviously been the real narrative shifter from both like an intense, from an attention perspective, but also, and you write about this, almost like a moral framing definition. I love you just to kind of like introduce, folks should definitely go look up your piece. But just a quick comment from you on the relation between Gaza and Ukraine and the broader moral stakes for the West, at least.
Well, I think the two conflicts are very different in many ways. I mean, they are similar, unfortunately, in the scale of human suffering, thousands of people killed, atrocities. But I think if you look at the moral picture there, in Gaza and Palestine, it's a very old conflict. It's a twice promised land, as I think Thomas Friedman once described it. And both the Palestinians and the Israelis deserve a future of dignity and independence and prosperity. And the issue is that they just have not been able to agree how to share that one land. And in Ukraine, it's a clear case of completely unprovoked invasion by a foreign country that has no, you know, there's, you know, the Ukrainians were not threatening Russia. They were not attacking Russia. They were not having terrorist attacks in Moscow. They just want to be left alone. And Russia wouldn't, because there is this imperial mindset in Russia and the idea that they must control Ukraine to be a great power, and they deserve to be a great power again. And so I think morally, the Ukraine war was much easier for me to cover, because it's just a much clear, much more clear-cut picture of good and evil.
And that's the thing. This is what I always point out to folks, which is I think the Western reaction to the Ukraine war would be far different if Ukrainians had jetted into Crimea and killed thousands of Russian beach vacationers in a, obviously, like there's a broader conflict, you know, 2014, but even that specific act would have been interpreted completely differently. And I think in many ways would have actually justified the ridiculous kind of Russian framings of the specific war. And the lack of a similar precipitating event here has to be, and once again, it's unfortunate how we have to, in like a kind of zero-sum media environment, kind of place conflicts together as if there's some sort of scale and weighing, because clearly, for good or for ill, these are just two different things. And I think treating them both interchangeably, or saying to yourself, well, because we did X in Ukraine, we have to do Y with Gaza and vice versa, isn't actually a productive way to kind of think through the big problems here. So here's the last question. I'm curious how you think Zelensky, leader of Ukraine, is going to evolve going into 2024. Because I think, as we've talked about during this episode, I think he's had a couple of different iterations, especially like in the Western context. So before 2020, he's sort of the bamboozled guy on the other line of an insane Trump call that leads to an impeachment inquiry. Then, you know, going into 2022, he's the guy who's kind of very publicly denying Western claims about a probable invasion. But then come February, he's the guy who, unlike Ashraf Ghani, unlike so many other Western allies, actually stood his ground in Kyiv. He has that very Churchillian aspect. But what kind of seems to be clear from my perspective is I think he's lost a lot of his persuasion ability when it's come to those 10 or so Republican senators who are on the fence about Ukraine aid. I think the current tactic he makes of making these very Russia's going to do this, Russia's going to do that, we need your aid this way, it just hasn't been effective with the current problem. So how do you think he's going to shift given his unproductive trip to Washington? Or is he going to continue on his current path?
I don't know. I mean, the question is, can he do anything to convince these Republicans who are opposed to Ukraine? Can any Ukrainian president convince them if they are opposed to it for reasons that maybe don't have anything to do with Ukraine? I think the issue, you know, people focus on Zelensky a lot, but it's not Zelensky's war. It's the war of the Ukrainian people. I have never seen a Ukrainian soldier speak about Zelensky, or I have never seen a Zelensky portrait in the front lines. You know, he happened to be in that seat in the presidential palace when the war began, and he embodied the resistance, and he was a very effective communicator in the first, say, year of the war, at least. But he, you know, the war is waged by a lot of people. The government is run by a lot of people. And I think as long as Zelensky and other leaders in Ukraine, such as, you know, the head of the armed forces, Zelensky, was very popular, and others continue to be able to work together, that's really all the Ukrainians want.
I think that's such an interesting place to close, because I think that is where the Zelensky-Churchill comparison is just so helpful in terms of understanding the dynamics, which is there's the Winston Churchill that the West, broader non-British West, saw during World War II. And then, you know, the one that we're watching, the Darkest Hour, that we kind of recall. Then there's the Winston Churchill, who the British quickly voted out of office as soon as the war in Europe was over. So it just seems to me that the difficulty for Zelensky to navigate is that, to your point, I think this is well stated, on the ground, no one in Ukraine would think of this as Zelensky's war. But in many parts of DC, for a variety of complicated reasons, he stands in as a single understandable character for the very, very, very complicated dynamics. And I think the lack of understanding of timelines of the events, which is why I think books like yours are so critical. So Yaroslav, this has been so helpful. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Great to be on the show. Thank you so much for having me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.